Today at your neurology clinic, you're seeing Jacob, one of your newer patients. He's 63 years old and was recently diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's disease, which is characterized by low dopamine content in the brain. This is the first time you're seeing him since you started him on carbidopa-levodopa, which aims to replenish the missing dopamine in the brain. You're happy to hear that his symptoms have improved since starting the medication. Later that day, as you prepare for your guest lecture next week at your alma mater's medical school, you decide to frame your presentation around Jacob's case, while of course preserving his anonymity. You want his initial presentation, diagnosis, treatment, and responsiveness to therapy to lead your story. You consider the essentials of the pathophysiology and biochemistry you need to include to explain why carbidopa-levodopa is currently the most effective therapy for Parkinson's disease. Hi, and welcome to Audio Breaks. I'm Alex Dennis, and this is the break on hormone classes, signaling pathways, and regulatory mechanisms. Let's jump right in. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Describe the major classes of hormones on the basis of chemical structure. 2. Compare and contrast the pathways involving intracellular and submembrane hormone receptors. 3. Compare and contrast the CAMP and IP3 signaling pathways. 4. Describe the common factors affecting target cell response to hormones. And 5. Discuss the stimulation and regulation of hormone secretion. Alright, this one is going to be an extensive study of hormones. We're going to embark on a sweeping journey through general structures, synthesis, signal transduction, and cell responses to these hormones, as well as the stimulation and regulatory factors affecting hormone secretion. We'll take this slow and not get too bogged down in unnecessary detail. Not to get you too excited, but if you have a solid grasp of what we're going to cover, understanding the mechanism of action of any hormone is going to be a piece of cake once you know its general category. Part 1. What are the different classes of hormones and how are they synthesized? Hormones are circulating molecules released in response to a stimulus with the goal of modifying an action either locally or far away. Now, that's a super vague explanation, so let's make this easy by splitting hormones into three classes based on structure: amines, peptides, and steroids. The easiest way to approach these is to contrast peptides to steroids and then tag along amines. In general, steroids are uncharged and tend to be smaller than their polypeptide counterpart. They have a hydrophobic carbon backbone derived from cholesterol, so they're lipid-soluble. On the other hand, the big and bulky polypeptides are water-soluble. You'll soon see that this solubility dichotomy is at the core of how blood transport and signaling pathway of these hormones differ. And then there's the amine hormones. Depending on their structure, they either fall in the water or lipid-soluble categories. Let's talk about this category of hormones first. Amines are hormones derived from the amino acids tyrosine and tryptophan. Thyroid hormones and catecholamines are important classes of amine hormones both derived from tyrosine, so we'll discuss those for a bit. The catecholamines, such as epinephrine, are often water-soluble and produced by the adrenal medulla, whereas the thyroid hormones are lipid-soluble and produced in the thyroid. Fun fact, actually, though the adrenal medulla is the major producer of epinephrine, it's actually only a minor contributor to all circulating catecholamines. But anyways, I digress. Catecholamines and thyroid hormones each have their own unique synthesis pathway, so let's go over them more closely. In the epinephrine pathway, you start off with tyrosine, and a bunch of steps later, you end up with your catecholamines of interest. Let's cut to the chase by stating the important intermediates and catecholamines in the correct order. Tyrosine is converted to DOPA, which is converted to dopamine, to norepinephrine, to epinephrine. It's sort of important to remember that order, but not to worry, because there are easy ways to remember it. Things have to start with tyrosine, because that's our starting amino acid for the amine hormones. From there, you have four intermediates left: DOPA, dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine. Group DOPA with dopamine, and norepinephrine with epinephrine, just based on name similarity. In terms of our first pair, you know that DOPA comes before dopamine because, besides sounding similar, DOPA is what's given to Parkinson's patients to replenish their dopamine levels. So dopamine has to be made from DOPA. For the other pair, the expression adrenaline rush reminds me that epinephrine, or adrenaline, is made from norepinephrine in flight or fight situations. If it were a noradrenaline rush, then norepinephrine would have to finish off the chain. And actually, the enzyme that catalyzes the reaction from norepinephrine to epinephrine, PNMT, is found primarily in the adrenal medulla, which is consistent with the fact that the medulla produces 90% of the circulating epinephrine. Anyways, I hope this wasn't too bad. many major pharmaceuticals and common diseases act on or interfere with this pathway, so having a general idea of the order of the steps comes in really handy. Let's do a quick throwback question. What amino acid are catecholamines derived from? Catecholamines and thyroid hormones derive from the amino acid tyrosine, which is derived from dietary sources as well as synthesis from phenylalanine. Now let's shift to the thyroid pathway. I want you to visualize the architecture of the thyroid. The thyroid is made up of a bunch of follicles, basically small secretory sacs, each of which are surrounded by cells, the follicular cells. The follicular lumen is what's inside the follicular bags. So, stimulation of the thyroid gland causes exocytosis of thyroglobulin from inside the surrounding follicular cells into the follicular lumen. Thyroglobulin has multiple tyrosines making up its structure, which makes it a great starting molecule for the remaining steps. Iodine is then also released into the lumen where thyroid peroxidase can oxidize and couple the iodine with tyrosine molecules from thyroglobulin. We now have the basic building blocks of our thyroid hormones, monoiodotyrosine, MIT, and diiodotyrosine, DIT. Thyroid peroxidase can then combine either one MIT and one DIT to form triiodothyronine, T3, or it can combine two DIT molecules to form thyroxine, T4. This is called conjugation. These thyroid hormones are absolutely crucial for body metabolism and energy utilization, and they also regulate fetal development. Quick pause here for a synthesis question. What are the three reactions catalyzed by thyroid peroxidase? Thyroid peroxidase mediates oxidation of iodide ions to iodine, couples iodine with tyrosine molecules on thyroglobulin to form MIT and DIT, and conjugates MIT and DIT to form the thyroid hormones. In short, oxidation, coupling, and conjugation. Alright, that's it for amines. We're one down, two to go. Peptides are hormones that consist of multiple linked amino acids. They can be short-chained peptide hormones or very large protein hormones. An example of a peptide hormone is antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, vasopressin. Growth hormone and insulin are examples of proteins. All of these hormones are generally water-soluble and can be somewhat linear chains of amino acids, peptides, or folded into a complex tertiary structure. Protein hormones are produced like any other protein through DNA transcription into mRNA and the final translation of that mRNA into amino acids. Synthesis can then be finalized in the endoplasmic reticulum where the peptides or proteins are formed before being sent to the Golgi for packaging. Recall from the enjoyable days of biochemistry that most large protein hormones are initially formed from prohormones similar to proenzymes. A portion of the prohormone must be cleaved before it can function as a hormone. There's actually a good analogy for this. Think of a factory making pens and then shipping them around the world with their caps on. Well, when you use your pen, you have to take off the cap before it's usable. Similarly, the cap pen is a prohormone and you must cleave the cap before the hormone is functional. However, unlike pens, you can't put the cap or prosequence back on the hormone. Less bang for your buck, I guess. Last but not least, let's talk steroids. Steroids are synthesized from cholesterol, which makes them fat-soluble. Examples of steroid hormones include estrogen, testosterone, and aldosterone. Before moving further, let's review some basics. Cholesterol can be broken down into two parts. The classic four-carbon ring structure you all know and love with the hydroxyl group in position 3 is the so-called sterol core. The second part is cholesterol's hydrocarbon side chain. Well, steroids are synthesized by essentially modifying the sterol core by adding one or more hydroxyl or carbonyl groups depending on what hormone you're trying to make. So that means that you're always keeping that four-ring sterol core, making steroid hormones very aptly named. Regardless of what hormone is being synthesized, the first step in making all steroid hormones is to transform cholesterol into pregnenolone. Pregnenolone is formed in the mitochondria but is shuttled to the smooth endoplasmic reticulum to undergo multiple additional enzymatic steps. This is actually a good place to mention that when you think of the smooth ER, you should instantly think lipid synthesis and in line with that, steroid hormone production. Anyway, the final products from the SER can undergo their last modifications in the endoplasmic reticulum, like with testosterone, or they can be shuttled back into the mitochondria, like with cortisol or aldosterone. Part 2. How do hormones act? Like we already hinted, Hormones can be either hydrophilic or hydrophobic based on their structure. Peptide and catecholamine hormones are characteristically hydrophilic, so water-loving, since they're either on the bulkier side, charged, or a mix of both. On the other hand, steroid and thyroidamine hormones are typically hydrophobic, so water-fearing. Solubility in water is at the core of understanding how hormone effects are achieved, since water solubility determines if a molecule will cross a cell membrane. Let's take it from the top and consider how our hormone gets to its target. Blood is an aqueous medium of water, proteins, salts, and cells. So water-soluble hormones can move freely in the interstitial space and in the blood without a transport protein, but they cannot cross the cell membrane. So it makes sense that there must be a receptor on the cell membrane that allows them to bind and signal downstream effects to exert an effect on the cell. We'll talk more about this in a bit. The fat-soluble hormones cannot freely travel in the blood because they don't dissolve in water. That means they need specific transport proteins to move about in the blood and extracellular fluids of the body. In contrast to water-soluble hormones, however, fat-soluble hormones can freely diffuse through their target cell membrane into the cell, since membranes are mostly made of lipids. There they bind to an intracellular target receptor, either in the cytoplasm or in the nucleus. This means that they do not require a second messenger to achieve their intracellular effect, but rather they directly bind to their receptor. Let's see what you got from this part. What form of hormone requires transport proteins in the blood? Transport proteins are often required by fat-soluble hormones like steroids. The transport proteins allow for travel through the primarily water-like blood and allow for a longer half-life of the hormone. Part 3. What are the signaling pathways used by hydrophilic hormones? The next important step to discuss is the exact mechanism of signal transduction. As we mentioned, the water-soluble hormones cannot cross the cell membrane. Since hormones need to bind to their receptors to exert their effect, this means receptors of water-soluble hormones must be located on the cell membrane. It also means that binding to the receptor must trigger some event inside the cell, since intracellular responses mediate hormonal actions. This intracellular signaling pathway is referred to as the secondary messenger. An important category of receptors for water-soluble hormones are the G-protein-coupled receptors, or GPCRs. The name says a lot about the structure of these receptors. There's a receptor part made of a 7-domain transmembrane protein, which is what the hormone binds to on the extracellular side. And then that receptor is coupled on the intracellular side to a G-protein complex which carries out the signaling cascade. The G-protein has an alpha, a beta, and a gamma intracellular subunit. Well, when the hormone binds to the extracellular portion of the receptor, a conformational change, basically a change in shape, happens that frees the alpha subunit from the G protein complex, sparking the signaling cascade. Now, the signaling cascade that ensues depends on the category of the G alpha subunit that was part of the G protein complex. G alpha subtype S subunits, when activated, stimulates adenyl cyclase to convert ATP to CAMP. CAMP goes on to activate protein kinase A, PKA, causing an increase in intracellular calcium. Conversely, the I subtype blocks the initial activation of adenyl cyclase, having the opposite effect we just mentioned, and ultimately resulting in a decrease in intracellular calcium. The final Q subtype uses phospholipase C that cleaves phosphatidyl inositol 4,5-bisphosphate into diacylglycerol and inositol triphosphate. The increased diacylglycerol goes on to activate phosphokinase C that acts to promote gene transcription. Inositol triphosphate goes on to liberate calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum, resulting in an increase in intracellular calcium. Some of the hormones that utilize the CAMP pathways used include the catecholamines, ADH at V2 receptor, FSH, LH, ACTH, and TSH. If you know the flat peg mnemonic, that's the flat portion of it. TRH, ADH at the V1 receptor, and angiotensin II use the IP3 pathway. Okay, we just mentioned how catecholamines signal via the CAMP pathway. If catecholamine binding results in increased concentrations of CAMP in the cell, what specific subtype of G-alpha protein is coupled to the catecholamine receptor? It tells you that the catecholamine receptor is coupled to a GS-alpha subunit. Part 4. What factors affect the target cell's response to hormones? Let's now shift to examining how cells can adapt to hormone stimulation, along with different interactions between hormones at the cell level. Adaptation is important for a balanced cellular response to hormone stimulation. For example, sometimes a gland can underproduce a hormone and the target cell becomes understimulated. The response of the target cell is to increase the number of receptors so that a balanced response can occur. This is called upregulation. On the other hand, if a gland overproduces a hormone, then the target cell would decrease the receptors so overstimulation would not occur. This is called downregulation. This allows cells to adjust sensitivity to the hormones in response to drastic changes in serum hormone level. This phenomenon can be seen in type 2 diabetes, where chronic elevations of insulin lead to the cells of the body to become desensitized and eventually resistant to insulin via receptor downregulation. Another important aspect of hormone action is the additive or inhibitory effect of different hormones acting simultaneously on one target cell or organ. This can be broken into permissive, synergistic, and antagonistic effects. Permissive effects refer to one hormone or molecule being required for another hormone to act at full capacity. Basically, one permits or allows the other's action. This can occur in the setting of specific B vitamins being required for other hormones to exert their actions. A classic example would be the upregulation of beta-adrenergic receptors by thyroid hormone, thus permitting epinephrine to exert its maximum effects on target cells. Synergistic effects refer to the positive or negative additive effects of two hormones acting together. This can be simply explained by the equation 1 plus 1 equals 3. The combination of two hormones acting together to produce an effect is greater than if we simply added up their individual effects. A classic example of this is the effect of reproductive hormones in the female body. Estrogens from the ovaries, in combination with FSH from the anterior pituitary gland, produces a greater stimulatory maturation effect on the female ova than either of these hormones has on its own. Antagonistic effects refer to hormones with opposing effects. The simplest example of this is the antagonistic effects of insulin and glucagon on serum blood sugar. These hormones are produced in the pancreas and neighboring cells, but glucagon works to break down glycogen stores in the liver and body. On the contrary, insulin works to store glucose as glycogen. Therefore, glucagon causes an increase in blood sugar, while insulin causes a drop in blood sugar. Alrighty, let's do a quick recap before moving on to the next part. What adaptive phenomenon occurs when too much hormone is acting on a target cell? The phenomenon that happens is called downregulation. This occurs from overstimulating a target cell so that the cell reduces, or downregulates, the number of receptors on the cell surface. The result is a decrease in the cell's sensitivity to the hormone. Part 5. How does the body regulate hormone secretion? You've been listening great so far, but we have one more topic to cover, and that's the discussion on regulating endocrine gland hormone secretion. This can occur through a humoral, hormonal, or neural stimulus and is further controlled by feedback. First, let's go over humoral. A humoral stimulus refers to the changes in the body's composition of nutrients and ions resulting in hormone release. For instance, in the case of high serum sodium, changes in transmembrane sodium concentration in the hypothalamus stimulate the release of ADH from the posterior pituitary gland. ADH then acts on the collecting ducts of the kidney to increase water reabsorption. This dilutes the blood and lowers the serum sodium concentration. The second type of regulation is through hormonal control. This can classically be seen in the hypothalamus or the pituitary gland. The hypothalamus is the master computer behind stimulating and inhibiting release of hormones around the body. For example, corticotropin-releasing hormone is secreted from the hypothalamus to stimulate corticotroph cells in the anterior pituitary gland. The anterior pituitary gland secretes ACTH that acts on the adrenal gland to stimulate growth and release cortisol. The last type of regulation is neural. This simply refers to the release of a hormone when stimulated by a neural signal. A common example is the stimulation of gastrin in the stomach during the rest and digest period. The parasympathetic nervous system, via the vagus nerve, stimulates gastric G cells to release gastrin in times of resting and eating. Let's see if you can apply the concepts we just went over. After you've satisfied your sweet tooth with a delicious scoop of ice cream, a rise in your blood glucose levels triggers insulin release. What type of hormonal stimulus is this scenario an example of? A rise in blood glucose triggering pancreatic insulin release is an example of a humoral stimulus. It wouldn't be right to talk about regulation without talking about feedback. Feedback refers to the stimulatory or inhibitory effect the final product has on the original stimulus. This can be broken into positive or negative feedback. Positive feedback means that the final effect triggers more stimulation of that cell, as in childbirth when the onset of labor causes continuous oxytocin secretion. In the much more common negative feedback, the end result feeds back to the original stimulus to stop secretion. This acts to stop secretion of a hormone when the desired effect is reached. Of the many examples, the simplest one is with the thyroid. The hypothalamus secretes thyrotropin-releasing hormone that promotes the anterior pituitary to secrete thyroid-stimulating hormone. TSH then binds to receptors on the thyroid gland and stimulates the production of T4 and T3. When cells in the pituitary gland sense that T4 and T3 have increased to a satisfactory level in the blood, they secrete less TSH and this stops the stimulation. Wow, we covered a lot. Let's see what you got and summarize the highlights. What are the three major classes of hormones on the basis of chemical structure? Hormones can be broken into three core groups: peptides, amines, and steroids. Peptide hormones are made of multiple amino acids and can be short, peptide, or long, protein hormones. They include ADH and growth hormone. Amine hormones are made from tyrosine and consist of thyroid hormones and catecholamines. Steroid hormones are derived from cholesterol and consist of aldosterone, testosterone, and estrogen. How does blood transfer differ for hydrophilic compared to hydrophobic hormones? Water-soluble or hydrophilic hormones can freely flow through the blood but cannot cross the cell membrane, which means they require a cell surface receptor to act. Lipid-soluble hydrophobic hormones need a transport protein to circulate in the blood, but since it can't cross the cell membrane, their receptor is either cytoplasmic or nuclear. What are some of the components of the CAMP signaling pathway that mediate the hormone's downstream effects? CAMP is a second messenger that increases pKa and calcium in the cell. Some hormones that use this method are catecholamines and ADH. IP3 is another second messenger that, with its other byproduct DAG, also increases calcium and pKc in the cell. What are some common factors that affect target cell response to hormones? Factors affecting cells' response to stimulation include receptor downregulation, receptor upregulation, permissive effects, synergistic effects, and antagonistic effects. What are the ways in which hormone secretion is stimulated? Endocrine stimuli can be humoral, by ions or molecules in the serum, hormonal, by stimulation from other hormones, or neural, by stimuli from neurons. And what are the ways in which hormone secretion is regulated? Positive feedback causes continued stimulation of hormone secretion, while negative feedback causes an inhibition of the upstream release of stimulating hormones. Armed with your newfound knowledge about hormone classes, signaling pathways, and regulatory mechanisms, let's revisit our case from earlier. You're taking the afternoon to prepare for your guest lecture on Parkinson's disease. You decided to frame your presentation around Jacob's case, your patient with early onset Parkinson's disease who's responding well to his carbidopa-levodopa regimen. How will you efficiently and effectively explain why this therapy is the most effective for this degenerative disease? After sharing that you initiated your patient on carbidopa-levodopa, you'll include a slide displaying the dopamine synthesis pathway. Tyrosine is hydroxylated to dihydroxyphenylalanine, DOPA, which is then decarboxylated to dopamine. You'll explain that levodopa is another name for L-DOPA and enantiomer of DOPA. This will be a great time to prompt your students about why L-DOPA might be used over dopamine, after which you'll reveal that it's simply a matter of protein carrier affinity. Dopamine cannot cross a protective blood-brain barrier, but levodopa, here acting as a prodrug, is transported into the brain and decarboxylated to form dopamine, which will relieve the dopaminergic deficiency by Parkinson's. This will be a great time to add that carbidopa is added to prevent premature conversion of levodopa to dopamine in the peripheral circulation. And that's a wrap for this one. Hopefully you've taken away that at the core of a lot of complicated sounding therapies and endocrine disorders lie some standard principles about hormone synthesis, solubility, and receptor-mediated signaling. Take care, until next time.